On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
My first guest is waiting on the line and I'm delighted to talk to him this morning. His name is Brian Rowan. He's a journalist and author. He's a former security editor for the BBC in Northern Ireland. He's also the author of a new book called Political Purgatory, which outlines the three-year closure of the Northern Ireland Assembly and Executive following the Cash for Ash scandal and all of the efforts that were needed to get it back to life. But he's a man who's very much aware of life on the ground and exactly what is going on in Northern Ireland. So I'm delighted to have him this morning. Brian, thanks very much for taking our call this morning and very much appreciate your time. The PSNI's assessment of the last couple of weeks is that the unrest hasn't been orchestrated or sanctioned by any kind of loyalist paramilitaries. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's multi-layered and it's multi-tiered, Gav. So if you look at the street violence, first of all, from so-called recreational rioting, and you read and you hear about the ages of young people involved, they would have no knowledge of the conflict period or the peace process. At another level, you have some people involved who have organisational links to factions of the loyalist organisations, factions of those groups now more identified with criminality, with drugs, with drug activity, that sort of stuff. And their interest is more self-interest than Ulster's interest, if you like. So the street violence has been localised. It's been in predictable pockets and places. Others in the loyalist leadership still have their foot on the brake, not wanting to go there, knowing the impact of that violence is to destroy their own communities and their cause in terms of the union. And I suppose that takes us to another tier, that political concern on the direction of travel at this time. And I said yesterday, you have to look through the smoke of that street violence to find the fire. And the anger and the fear in the loyalist unionist community is that they have been constitutionally unnerved by the post-Brexit fallout. Mm. That Irish Sea trade border, creating in minds further difference and distance between this place and the rest of the United Kingdom.
Sure.
And the union no longer is safe, and certainly not as safe as when declared as such by the combined loyalist military command in their ceasefire statement of 1994.
We'll come back maybe to the direction of travel in just a few minutes, but I suppose then it's a point you've just touched on there, the idea of some people acting in self-interest. If this is not being sanctioned by paramilitaries and it obviously doesn't have any political backing or blessing or sanction, then where exactly is this unrest coming from? And when you say people are acting in their self-interest, what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I need to explain that in this way, that in the period 1994-98, that critical period of the peace process stretching from the ceasefire through to the Good Friday Agreement, you had joined up loyalism. You had that combined loyalist military command. The loyalist political representatives were part of the Good Friday Agreement negotiation. They helped David Trimble carry the weight of that agreement. Mm. Now, since then, in the 20 years plus since then, loyalism has become a fractured community. There are many competing interests within it. You had a five-year period of feuding within the loyalist organizations when all of them recruited. The organizations are probably bigger now than they were in the conflict period. And having marched all of those young people onto the stage, the question then becomes, how do you march them back off the stage? So, and within each of the loyalist organisations, and particularly the UDA, there are many factions. So in that area of South East Antrim, that part of the organisation is no longer associated or affiliated with the mainstream UDA organisation. Mm-hmm. They do their own thing. Police have been involved in raids in that area recently, directed against drugs crime, involving that faction of the UDA. And when I talk about self-interest, they're out on the street giving the pretense of doing something to defend Ulster, defend communities, defend the union. But really what it is it's trying to gloss over the real activities they're involved in now, which is organised crime, Gav. That's what I meant by that point.
So then all of what we've seen in the last couple of weeks, although there may be a perception that it's been fuelled by concerns on the protocol or concerns around non-prosecution over Bobby Storey's funeral, that actually it is actually more to do with the clampdown on the South East Antrim UDA.
Well, and that's not to say that within the loyalist unionist community there's not a fear about the direction of travel post-Brexit. Of course, there is a fear about that. But what I'm saying is that you go out and if you talk to some of those people who are involved in that violence on the street, they will have no idea of the post-Brexit implications. They will have no idea of how much danger some believe the union is in. So the violence becomes an excuse. The point I'm making is if the mainstream loyalist leadership wanted to turn this thing on the street, they could. And then it wouldn't be localized, it wouldn't be isolated, it wouldn't be in those predictable pockets, it would be everywhere. And, you know, I've read some coverage and heard some coverage this week about this being the worst violence since the Good Friday Agreement. That is absolute nonsense. I heard Padraig O'Brien on Channel 4 last night talk about those who talk about the bad old days don't understand just how bad the bad old days were. So we've got to keep a context to this. So you've got that street play, if you like, but also at a higher political community level. There is this concern about the Brexit issue. And it has to be said, Gav, that some of those who shouted loudest for Brexit are now shouting loudest about the concerns they have for the union. Mm. And so we wait to see how all of that plays out.
Yeah.
There is also a very clear view within the loyalist and unionist community that all this violence is doing is destroying loyalist communities. And I know for a fact that during some of that rioting in the past couple of weeks, some of those loyalists who would have been involved in the peace process, negotiations and period, were on the streets taking petrol off young people, taking bricks off young people, and they don't want to see another generation of those young people run to the front lines of this place with petrol bombs and bricks in their hands. They've been down that road. They believe the wars are over, and they also believe that the conversation about where we are now requires a dialogue and needs everyone in the room.
And I'll come back to just that point as a final question in a minute, but just because you mentioned the direction of travel, I mean, okay, granted, if a lot of this is just cover for a clampdown on the criminal actions of one particular branch or wing of the UDA, nonetheless, there is the direction of travel, there's the effect that the Northern Ireland Protocol exists in the first place, and there's the perhaps the sense of two-tier policing because of the decision not to prosecute over the funeral last year. There's a general sense that if you consider Northern Ireland to be zero sum, and it probably shouldn't, but many do, that there is this sense now of a two-tier society where loyalists and unionists do genuinely feel like the union is getting away from them. Is that justified, or what would you say to those who do feel that?
Well, let me say that in the period 1994 to 98 and then beyond for many years, loyalist representatives were at the heart of negotiations here. I hear this argument on occasion that the peace process has left them behind. I believe that some in the loyalist communities left the peace process. And that's that element of loyalism now involved in criminality, in drugs, in organized crime, and their interest being self-interest. When I talk about the direction of travel, what I mean is the much louder conversation now, Gavin, about a new Ireland.
Mm.
So we have this centenary year in Northern Ireland. It's meant to be a year of celebration for the unionist community. A loyalist, senior loyalist, said to me in recent weeks, we have a choice in 2021. We can celebrate it or we can destroy it. But that new Ireland conversation is now a mainstream conversation. Now, for me, it has to be about much more than a vote. The new Ireland has to be the New Ireland conversation has to be a blank sheet conversation. What is the Northern political construct within a New Ireland? What is Britishness and unionism and identity when we talk about a New Ireland? Is it an economically creditable and viable project? What is the transition period? And the New Ireland can't be the old Ireland. You know, we still have an unresolved past here in the North. We've no legacy process. And we've been trying to build politics on top of what a senior police officer describes in my book as the mass grave of the Troubles period. And what I mean by, and what he means by a mass grave, is all of that hurt and all of those competing narratives and truths that have never been addressed.
What?
So I think that is the concern in the unionist community, that sea border has created further distance and difference between this place and the rest of the United Kingdom. And that's happening at a time when that New Ireland conversation is becoming both louder and more creditable.
Sure, that image of the mass grave, which you mentioned in the book, it's quite a powerful one, but it does bring me to the final thing that I wanted to ask you, because, you know, we're now 23 years on this weekend from the signature of the agreement of Good Friday, and many in the South and around the world probably naively thought that was it, that there would be teething problems, but that the North was sort of fixed. Is it ever going to be fixed, and I use that word quite crudely, without there being some kind of process to deal with, you know, like a truth commission or something else to deal with the underpinning legacy issues? Or will it always be haunted by those past things that haven't been addressed until they are tackled?
Well, I think peace is always a work in progress, Gav. And 23 years ago, I was a non-believer. I didn't believe that the Good Friday Agreement could be achieved. We didn't understand at that time the meaning of the process. And that you get the agreement and then you spend years of argument to try to get the agreements implemented. So I think until we address the past in some way, and I don't believe that we can ever achieve an absolute truth, and I mean that across all of the sides to the conflict, that there is not going to be such a thing as an absolute truth. And I used a term a few years ago that it was time to stop lying about the truth. And what I mean by that is that we need to be more honest about what can be achieved in some information retrieval or truth recovery process. Now, the problem we have is we've had a decade plus of negotiation and consultation trying to build a legacy process, and it falls apart every time. And the problem with all of that, Gav, is that there are still some in politics who are trying to use the past to win. And my very clear view is that we need someone from outside of us to shape a legacy process. In all of the big moments of this process, the politics of Good Friday, we needed Senator George Mitchell. The process of policing reform, we needed Chris Patton. The process of arms decommissioning, we needed General John de Shastlin. And yet we think on the two biggest issues in front of us, our past and our future, that we can do it ourselves. And to me, that's just nonsense. So I think that blank sheet conversation that I talk about in terms of a New Ireland should be facilitated and chaired from people from outside of us, that we should have a chair for everyone in the room. And having described to you a moment ago what I thought in 1998, that I thought it was an impossible task in that period of Good Friday 1998, the agreement was made. And I think it is through dialogue and bringing everyone into the room and everyone into the conversation that we might be able to talk our way out of this current mess. But I also hold the very firm view, Gavin, that if Stormont fails again, then it should fail forever. Julian Smith and Simon Coveney, and you were about that negotiation at that stage, put that process back together after 3 years without government. I don't think there would be any tolerance for an executive falling again and another period of years of vacuum. It's had its chance, and it now needs to deliver. But we're in a situation at the moment that the pandemic is the thread on which that executive hangs. So we seem a long way from that moment and that initiative that Julian Smith and Simon Coveney shaped just a little over a year ago.
But it will have to be tackled at some point, and they might sound like fairly trite or tired talking points, but they are as true today as they are as they ever were. Brian, we will let you go. Thanks so much for your time this morning, and thank you for biding with us while we tried to rescue your line earlier. That's Brian Rowan.
Thank you very much, Brian.
He's a former BBC security editor in Northern Ireland. He's a journalist, and he's the author of Political Purgatory, The Battle to Save Stormont and The Play for a New Ireland, recently published by Merrion Press here in Dublin.